Hello and welcome to the podcast for Christ Community Church in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. This is the message that Tom Jobe recorded for our service, which aired on Sunday morning, June 14th, 2020. And he spoke from Daniel chapter 9.
So what I was going to try to do in these weeks is just like of the coronavirus, when everything is calm and kind of on hold and everything was chill, just look at some, you know, I was just thinking, how do we pray during the time of the coronavirus? So I was thinking about looking at some like mega prayers of the Old Testament of people who prayed in times of crisis, like Abraham and Moses. And then, so this week, well, like a couple of weeks ago, I was ready for this week, which was this amazing prayer in the book of Daniel, in chapter 9, where Daniel prays this prayer of confession, of like confession of like the sins of like his people, because they hadn't listened to the voice of the prophets. And I thought, okay, so while everything is calm and on hold and chill, maybe that would be a good thing to do, of just like think, have we really listened? Because, well, okay, what happened was, some people asked me, do you think the coronavirus is like the judgment of God? And I was like, I don't think you can really know that. Like, there's no way to know it. You would have to have a prophet like Isaiah or Jeremiah, because that's kind of what they did. They would always say, this is happening because of this and because you all did this or that. But one thing about reading the prophets is you can always find out what, when God looks at like a people in a society, what matters to him and things that that he's super concerned about. And maybe it would be a good time to look at those and say, do I care about the things that God cares about? And do I care about things that God doesn't care about? Am I missing anything? This would be a great time of looking at that in confession. For example, like when I accepted Jesus, when I was 20, the thing that I always started to hear was Christians who are like liberal Christians, like, you know, these ones and those ones, they believe in what they call the social gospel, like helping the poor and social justice and all that. But real Christians believe in evangelization and sharing the message of Jesus with everyone. And then when you read the prophets, you find out that God super cares about both of those. And he super cares about care for the poor and love for those who are disadvantaged and oppressed and vulnerable. Can I just read you one or two? Like, okay, so this comes from Isaiah chapter 10. Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees and deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed of my people. And what will you do on the day of reckoning? In chapter 58, he says, is this not the kind of fasting I've chosen, to loosen the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke and set the oppressed free? Is it not to share your food with the hungry and provide the poor wanderer with shelter? And if you see the naked people, to clothe them. If you do away with the yoke of oppression, with the pointing finger and malicious talk, and if you spend yourself on behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed, then your light will shine in the darkness and your night will be like the noonday. He said in chapter 8, hear this, you who trample the needy and do away with the poor of the land. The Lord has sworn by himself, I will never forget anything they've done. You know, so it's like there's just a whole bunch of those. So I thought maybe when it's really chill like this and calm in the time of the coronavirus, we could look at and maybe confess, have we cared about things that God cares about? You know, and then, You know, then and then George Floyd was killed. Who was a person who, he was super involved in like developing the Christian hip hop music in the Houston area. Because he had been reached for Jesus by people who cared about both of those, who cared about social justice and sharing the message of Jesus. But then all of a sudden, it's not chill anymore in America, and it's not calm. The streets are filled and the air is filled with people who are saying enough of social injustice and enough of racial inequity and inequality, enough. So Tina and I, like we left the United States when I was 30 in 1985. And we went to Italy. We were going to stay forever. But for a variety of reasons, we stayed until 1996, like for 11 years. And when we came back, I was kind of surprised by a couple of things. And one of them was that there was still such a thing as the high school prom. Like I didn't think that the high school prom had survived like the late 60s and the early 70s. And another thing happened to me that it was an expression of like racial prejudice. And I was like, really? I didn't realize that it had survived the 70s. So when we went to Italy, we were just sharing the gospel in a lot of different ways in a big, super big city. And people started coming to know the Lord, and a lot of young Italians in their 20s. Some of them were like, had different problems. We had a few people who came to know the Lord who were Italian, but who were suffering from HIV/AIDS. But we also had a lot of people. We had people from different cultures and from different countries. Like the first two people we ever baptized were two young students from Lebanon, one named Ghazi, who was the national youth lute champion of Lebanon. And another one was a young man named Antoine, who became like just one of my best friends ever. But one thing that was super cool about Antoine is when he wrote his name like in cursive, Antoine Stefan, and then without lifting up his pen, he would come underneath it and write it going the other way in Arabic. He had the coolest signature I ever knew. But we started to get people in our church from, you know, we had people from Switzerland and from Africa and from various Middle Eastern countries. I mean, a lot of Italians, but also people from Latin America and the Philippines, and like on our leadership team and elder board, we would have an elder from, you know, Italians and us, and, you know, an African and Lebanese and a guy from Finland. We had people from over 17 countries in one of our churches, and it felt like heaven. It felt like, yeah, this is what heaven is going to be like people from everywhere. And it felt like a family. Like we were like a family every holiday, like, you know, that weren't like, you know, kind of like Class B holidays, like, you know, different holidays, you're not really sure what's about, but it's a holiday. And they were always like, what are we going to do? And we'd always go to a park and cook out. And every Sunday after church, whoever didn't have anywhere to go would come to our house and stay for like ever. But it was like a family. We had nothing in common except the love of Jesus. And, you know, so we wound up getting so many Egyptians, and a lot of them didn't speak the Italian language. So they wanted to have a church of their own. So Antoine and I, we started, it was really at the time the first Arabic language Protestant Christian church in Italy, and it was awesome. The only thing, I was a little bit sad that we were doing that, because I loved it all together, because in a country that had rising racial tension, because they had growing numbers of immigrants, especially from Africa and the Middle East, we were a living testimony that Jesus Christ is risen from the dead, because we were a family. You know, so when our kids got ready to go to college, and we realized they had never really lived here. And so we realized that we were needed to come home. And Jim McNamee started talking to me about starting a church in Oak Ridge. And I was like, it seemed like Oak Ridge had a bunch, but he gave me his reasons. And so, but there was a young couple, the Christmas before we came back, that we were friends with, Darnell and Erica. And Darnell was working on his PhD at UT, and they came and spent Christmas with us. And Darnie was working with worship in at Fellowship Church, which was one of our supporting churches. But he wanted to go further and go deeper. He wanted to be like a worship pastor. So we started talking about this church. And Darnie and Erica, we said to them, if you'll do it, we'll do it. And Darnie and Erica said to us, if you'll do it, we'll do it. Darnie wound up, he was really Lee's mentor and taught him how to lead worship. But Darnie was our worship leader and pastor at the beginning. And then we were renting someplace, I can't remember. And then I realized that, well, there was a couple who came and visited and they didn't come back. And I found out the reason they didn't come back. Well, Erica is a Filipino American and Darnell is an African American. And that's why they didn't come back. And I was like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? What about we're a family? What about heaven, where we're all gonna be together? What about Jesus risen from the dead? And he makes us into one. What about that? But then after like five years of working in a county jail and almost 10 years working in like a state prison, like going in every week and sharing Jesus and, just serving, just doing ministry for almost 10 years. And I think the biggest state prison in Tennessee. And you realize like after being in there, it doesn't take long to realize there are a lot of things that aren't fair. That are still not fair. There's a lot of things that aren't just. And so there was there's a guy that I was reading and listening to him, a guy named Brian Stevenson. So Brian Stevenson is a lawyer and he teaches at New York University, but he's the guy that wrote the book Just Mercy. And the movie is about him. And he started something called the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. So he's gotten 157 people off of death row who were accused of crimes that they didn't commit. He said 1 in 9 of the people that are executed in the United States are innocent of the crimes that they're executed for. But Brian Stevenson when he talks about like things that are unjust and racial injustice in the criminal justice system, he said this goes way back, that this is like a 400 year thing. And he talks about like slavery, and he was like, he said, you know, when you have a history where 13 million people are kidnapped from their country and brought here, a third of them die on the way. Millions of people were worked to death, exploited sexually and in every other way, when like slave sales indicated that 50% of the slave sales, a child was sold from their parents. 7 or 5 or 7 or 10 year old child was never to see him again. Almost 50%, a husband or a wife were sold away from each other, never to see each other again. And then he said, you know, like if you look at the 150 years since, and just the discrimination and the, like Jim Crow laws, but one thing that he So one thing that Bryan Stevenson did was he built a memorial to the over 4,700 African Americans to honor them and to remember their name, but African Americans who were murdered by mobs with impunity because somehow they violated some imaginary social whatever. But it was really because they weren't wanted there. And he's like, we've never looked at that. Like 4,700. Lynching victims. And they had names. And they lived in towns and villages. A couple of years ago, we went to Washington, D.C. with our grandkids. And so, I think it was our last full day there. I was jogging like on the National Mall, and they have the new Museum of African American History. And I knew that you had to have tickets like way ahead of time to get in. But I wanted to get in, and I just prayed. I said, Jesus, I want to get into this museum today. So about 2 o'clock that afternoon, I think the kids went to the zoo. And so when we had that afternoon to ourselves, and so we just kind of went there, and we were standing at the door of the admission. There was a line, and a woman turned around and said, does anyone need 2 tickets? And we said, we do. And she said, here you go. We didn't need all these. And I said, you know, I asked Jesus this morning to give me those 2 tickets. And she said, we serve a mighty God. I said, yeah, we do. But anyway, you go upstairs and there's all the, you know, one whole floor dedicated to sports. And there's a floor dedicated to music. The first thing I saw, I knew exactly what it was. It was a dress. And I knew what it was. It was the dress that was worn by Marian Anderson when she was the first African-American soprano to sing at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. And Eleanor Roosevelt arranged for her to sing a concert of classical music at the concert hall of the Daughters of the American Revolution, but they wouldn't let it happen because she was African-American. And that day, Eleanor Roosevelt quit the Daughters of the American Revolution and arranged for her to sing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And she sang 45 minutes of classical music, and then she sang, my country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. And on the last verse, she changed it to, of we, of thee we sing. But the bottom three floors, is the history of slavery in America. And the middle floor is about like Reconstruction and, you know, and Jim Crow laws and all of that. And then the next floor is about the civil rights movement. And there was an exhibit, and it was the funeral furnishings for the funeral of Emmett Till, who was a 14-year-old boy from Chicago who went down to visit his cousin in Mississippi, and somebody said they thought they heard him whistling at a woman in the town. And he was taken from his bed and, you know, he was beaten and killed and thrown in the river. And the line to get in to see the exhibit was about an hour long. And I noticed that almost everybody in the line who was waiting an hour to get in was over 70. Just because, you know, it felt like something that was burned into their heart. And, you know, it's just like Bryan Stevenson said, we've never looked at this stuff. We've never confessed it. So in Daniel chapter 9, it's the end of 70 years in Babylon. Like they had been exiled into Babylon. And the reason is because for 500 years, they had never observed what was called the Shemitah, or the Sabbath year. Every 7 years, they couldn't cultivate their fields or plow or sow them. Just let them rest for a year. And all debts were canceled. And sometimes if a person had to go into servitude because they couldn't pay their debts and they were working off their debts, even if they hadn't paid their debts at the end of a set of 6 years, they were set free. It was about equality and about justice and about social equality. And they had never done it for 500 years. And now it's about to get over and they were going to go back. And Daniel was probably, what if we don't repent of this? Like, what if we go back to being the way we were? I'll confess it. So, like, he has this prayer where he said, "Great and mighty God, we have sinned against you. 4 times we've sinned against you, done wickedly. We didn't listen to what the prophet said about justice and about fairness and about equality and about the oppressed and the deprived and the vulnerable and the immigrant. We didn't listen to you. I confess it." He didn't do it. He was 11, like when they went to Babylon. He was about 80 something. He didn't do it, but he's like, "I'll confess it." And it's almost like if somebody doesn't confess it, it just keeps going. You know, I saw one time, it was a commercial on TV. It was somebody that, you know, was really funny, one of the late night comics, you know, and he was playing different people on, I think it was a credit card commercial. And he played, "Now I'm a farmer and, you know, on a tractor and then a businessman." And then he played an Italian, and it was just like an Italian with that blue and white shirt that the gondolieri wear in Venice, you know, and like a mustache, and he was throwing a pizza, like, "I'm an Italian," you know, and I just, like, that's a culture that I love. It's a people that I love. My two oldest kids spoke Italian with a Florentine accent. My two youngest kids spoke Italian with the accent from Milano. Italians aren't like that. They're short, they're tall, they're blonde, they're redheaded. They don't have any more mustaches than we do. It isn't right to do people that way, because the thing about it is, like, one of the largest lynchings in American history was in New Orleans in 1891, where 11 Italians were killed. Because people hated them. In the New York Times, it said, in the New York Times in 1891, it said, "Yeah, but they're just those sneaky Sicilians, the descendants of bandits and assassins, and they come here with their lawless passions. It would be easier to make citizens of rattlesnakes." And I'm like, wow. But sometimes you hear that language about their criminals and used of Latino immigrants that come here. The ones that I know aren't that way. The ones that I know are kind and sweet, and they're working hard. Mom and dad working hard to raise a family. So, like, last year one day I was working in the Knox County schools with student translating for Latino families for student teacher conferences in the elementary school. And there was, and you know, these little families would come in just like a little third grader, and his hair is just combed over and with his mom or with his mom and dad, and they didn't understand a word of English, but the little boy, he speaks it perfectly, you know, because he's been in the school system. And so the teacher would, and the first question that the mom and dad ask is, "How is his behavior in school?" And then I would tell the teacher what she asked, and then the teacher would say, and that was always the first question, and the teacher would say, "He is so good. He works so hard, and he's never a problem, and he's just trying to sit there calm, but you can just see him kind of fill up with sunshine, you know, because," and then I'll tell the mom, and then she'll be so happy, and her next question is, "How's he doing academically?" And the teacher said, "He is so smart, and he's just growing so fast, and he just does all of his work always on time." And the little boy's just kind of like, waiting for his mom to hear, you know? Oh, so Daniel, it's just like, Daniel said, you know, "I'll confess it." Like, "I'll confess if nobody will confess it." You know, by the way, New Orleans, the city of New Orleans apologized for that mob murder in 1891. They did it in 2019. But Daniel said, I'll confess it. If nobody else will confess it, I'll confess it. And I'll tell God we've sinned against you. He didn't do it. He was like 11 when they went to Babylon. He was like 80. He didn't do those things, but he said, I'll confess them. If nobody will confess them, I'll confess them. That we've sinned against you 4 times. He said, we've sinned against you. We did wickedly. We didn't listen to the prophets. And then you think, what good does that do? Like, what if you decided, I'm just going to confess, like, you know, 400 years of discrimination and oppression of the most vulnerable of those who have been discriminated. I'll confess it. And you think, well, you didn't do it. I don't know, but I just will. What good would it do? I don't really know, but I do know that as soon as Daniel finished his prayer, the angel Gabriel flew, it says, in swift flight to tell him something. That's pretty awesome. And he found out something that Gabriel told him a prophecy about that's super complicated, but about 600 years before it happened, he told them in from a certain date, and depending on where you count it, in 173,880 days, the Messiah is going to walk into the gate of Jerusalem, and that Palm Sunday would be on the 27th of March, 33 AD, 600 years before it happened. But one thing, you know, like, there, if I just feel like, I just want to confess. Like, I want to know the freedom of confessing what's wrong. I mean, it's just like, you wind up knowing yourself better. You're like, I don't know, my own heart. Like, I the way I think, I might have got... I got it from my family. I got it from my friends. Heaven forbid I got it from cable news, but it may not be what I want to know the way God wants me to think. I want to know what's wrong with the way I think. God, will you tell me? I promise I'll confess it. Will somebody tell me? I promise I'll admit it. You know, in all of this, everybody's just been saying, you know, their opinion. But very few people say, do you think I'm right? Will you tell me? If you think I'm wrong, will you tell me, please? Because I want to know the truth about myself. I don't want to be wrong anymore. I want to care about the things that God cares about. You wind up, if you embrace the freedom of confession, you know yourself better. And you wind up knowing Jesus better because, I mean, for Daniel, this was a personal thing. Daniel chapter 9 in that confession uses the personal name for God for the very first time in the book of Daniel. And he said, God, in this confession, he said, you have made a covenant of love with us. The word for love is a Hebrew word, chesed. It means commitment and love. And you're committed to loving us, to never letting us go. Just like knowing Jesus, like I'm declared righteous. He's never going to let me go. I'm his. I'm washed. I'm clean. That doesn't mean I don't have to confess anything. It means I'm safe to. Nothing happens. You know, nothing happens. And I just say to Jesus, anything about me, I don't care about being right. I care about being, I don't know, holy. I care about being what you want me to be. I don't want any hate in me. I want to be like you. More than anything in the world, I want to learn to love. Whatever I need to know about myself and about you, I'll admit it and embrace it. You know, there was a, Brian Stevenson said that one of the things they've done at the memorial they built outside of Montgomery for the 4,700 African Americans that were murdered by mobs in the South from 1880 to 1950, is they've collected soil from every site that they have documented where all across the South. And they've asked volunteers to go fill a quart mason jar with soil from that site. And there was an African-American middle-aged woman who volunteered to go, and it was a little bit intimidating. But they said, if anybody asks you what you're doing, just say it's for my garden or whatever. But anyway, she went to the site in southern Alabama, and she was collecting soil from the site where an African-American had been murdered by a mob in 1931. And a truck drove by, and there was a white person in it. And he looked at her and slowed down and looked at her, and then he went on. And then he came back and he looked at her. And then he stopped and he got out of the truck and he said, "What are you doing?" And she said, she just said she was just filled with like the Holy Spirit. And she said, "An African-American man was lynched here in 1931 and I've come to honor his memory." And he said, "Do you have documentation?" She said, "I do." And he said, "Could I read it?" And he did. And he said, "Do you mind if I help you?" She said, "No." She handed him her little shovel. He said, "No, you use it." And he used his hands. And before you know it, he was crying. Before you know it, she was crying. And he said, "Have I upset you?" And she said, "No, you have blessed me." And he was crying so hard. And he said, "My biggest fear is that my grandfather was involved in this." And they just sat down on the ground when it was over and cried together. And he said, "Can I take your picture holding the jar?" And she said, "If I can take your picture holding the jar." And then when they installed the jar at the memorial, they met that day together and they installed it together. Wow.
Can I take a second to confess, letting go of holding on? Rags I'm in, I'm ready to undress. They've clung to me for far too long. I've been afraid and looked down with fear on strangers speaking foreign tongues. I've judged on looks, clothes, creed, and race, dismissed both the old and young. Unfair quips passed man to man, I've posted for the world's view. Wisdom spewed like a drunken fan, sorry if it got on you. We have clothed ourselves in rags of privilege that can't conceal how we've become immune to all the heartbreak can no longer feel. But with the courage to confess, and if you're willing to undress, you'd be amazed by the sorrow it might heal. It's hard to see and tough to find remnants of the man I've been. Some parts run deep and are hid behind what's handed down kin to kin. Risk the chance, make a friend, shake the hand, hold the young. The highest privilege in the end, to love the ones you live among. But we've clothed ourselves in rags of privilege that can't conceal how we've become immune to all the heartbreak we can no longer feel. But with the courage to confess, and if you're willing to undress, you'd be amazed by the sorrow it would heal. Risk the chance, make a friend, shake the hand, hold the young. The highest privilege in the end, to love the ones you live among.